This episode of Inciting a Riot was recorded on the lands of the Dja Dja Wurrung people in Australia. We'd like to pay our respect to elders past, present and emerging, and extend that respect to any First Nations people listening today.
Grab your pitchfork, light your torch, and get ready for Inciting a Riot. Conventional thinking has been warned, because we're going to gather and we're going to march and we're going to blow its f***ing house down.
Hello, rioters, and welcome back to Inciting a Riot, the podcast. I would be your left-wing dirt-worshipping host, Firelight. Today, I am so excited because I get to present to you a conversation with Josephine Winter, the author of the new book, Fire Magic, which, as you can imagine, is a subject near and dear to my fiery, fiery little heart. I got the pleasure of getting to read an advanced copy and write a blurb for Josephine a little bit before her book was set to come out. And I have to tell you, I needed to get her on the show for a number of reasons that will come up later on when you all hear. But Josephine is a Wiccan of many, many years. She is a practitioner down in Australia who brings with her an incredibly unique perspective that we don't often hear here in the Northern Hemisphere, especially here in the United States. It's so great to see books being published by our pagan big two that are featuring voices from sort of beyond the United States. I'm so glad to see that. But what struck me about Fire Magic is that while it's sort of an introductory book, I mean, it's certainly an introduction to working with the element of fire, and in all of its aspects, and there's deities and herbs and stones and spells and rituals and ideas and thoughts and things. But my gosh, it was such an incredible book because you got this perspective about what it's like to live in an area that experiences wildfires and actual, you know, times whenever the country is set ablaze. In fact, Josephine was, you know, while we were recording this, there were fires raging near her home. It's such a unique and personal book to Josephine, and I really, really, really loved it. And I'm so glad to see that there's these more nuanced books that are out on the market now for beginners. I'm glad to see that, you know, some of the discussions around crystals featured discussions about the mining industry. And, you know, there was just a lot of nuance in the book that I really appreciated and think you all will too. I think you're going to really, really, really enjoy this conversation. So I'm not going to talk too much longer. Here is my chat with Josephine Winter. Josephine Winter, welcome to Inciting a Riot. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You are the author of the new book that just came out on July 7th called Fire Magic, which, I mean, how could somebody write a book about fire magic and not come on my podcast to talk about it? I mean, come on. Come on.
I was really hoping you'd have me, so I was secretly very chuffed.
That's writing a book called Fire Magic is almost like saying, please, Firelight, please have me on your show, please. Thank you so much. Please, yes, please. Thank you. So for folks who don't know about you and your platform, tell people a little bit about yourself.
So I'm Josie. I am an author and a journalist from Australia. I write for The Wild Hunts as the Australian correspondent over there. I'm an Alexandrian witch, and I do a whole lot of community building sort of stuff here in Australia. So I, for my sins, I volunteer a lot and run a few community groups. I've founded the Pagan Collective of Victoria, which is a statewide nonprofit which is coming up on its, I think we're 8 years old this year. Yeah, that's me.
Oh, that's amazing. That's amazing. And you wrote the book Fire Magic, which is part of Llewellyn's sort of elemental magic series. Sister authors, you have Lilith Dorsey, who wrote Water Magic, and you're here, you wrote Fire Magic. What about fire magic appeals to you most?
I think fire as an element appeals to me most because it's so unique. It's the only element that can be created of mm-hmm. the four, and the only that one that can be destroyed too. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a lot of beauty in that fragility. For something that can cause so much damage, it's also so fragile.
When I think of fire in magic, I always think of Jean Grey, which baby witch Firelight would roll his eyes about so hard. But I always think of Jean Grey because in the Marvel universe, she's the Phoenix, and her metaphysical fire powers are sort of a tool of destruction, but also of creation. And that's how I always think of fire as a magical ally. It's this tool that, you know, I always think of it like, you know, the power of the two-edged sword. It can both cut and cure. It can both heal and harm. It is a very dual-natured element. And I love it because it's just a little bit chaotic. You can't really look away from it too much. You can't keep your eye off that candle. You can leave a bowl of water sitting there and it's probably going to be fine. You can leave that plant and the air, you know, it's all around you. You're breathing it. But that fire, you got to watch it because it can burn your whole house down.
Yeah. I mean, the first draft of the book was basically read like a safety manual. Was Josie's big book of, no, don't do that.
I empathize greatly because I'm just recently, you know, wrote a book too. And it's just like every time I go to like write about like fire or snow or something like that, I'm like, okay, so you can do magic with this, but like, please remember your fire safety. Please, 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 please.
Yeah. And like, don't light fires in your house, please. Please.
So fire for an Australian is, you know, a pretty big deal. You all go through, I mean, like we go through it here. We're actually going through a pretty big drought in the Western United States right now as we're recording this. And we are prepping for a very serious fire season. Disasterologists are sort of screaming from the rooftops right now here stateside. Dr. Sam Montano is like, dedicated her entire Twitter to making sure people know that there are severe drought situations right now. But you all have like a very serious fire season and you write about it in the book as well. Tell me about like, you know, your perspective being in Australia with fire.
Well, I wrote the book during the worst bushfires we've ever had. A lot of people have forgotten because there's been a pandemic since then, but sort of in December, January 2019, 2020, huge parts of our country were on fire. And they were just devastating. And it was quite difficult to be staying awake all night watching, because we have an app that tracks fires. I live in the country and my house backs onto bushland, so you know we're pretty vigilant about that sort of stuff. So to stay awake with that worry all night and then to get up each morning and be like, oh, so how else is fire magical? Let me think. You know,
eat fire great.
Yeah.
Let me write more about how much I love fire.
Yeah, so that was very interesting. I think people were calling it a natural disaster, and often bushfires are, but at what point when these bushfires are created by man-made kind of climate change and man-made stuff, when do we stop calling these a natural disaster?
These fires, gender reveal party gone wrong.
Yeah, exactly. The fires here, though, they were so big and so hot that they were creating their own weather systems, which would move in front of them mm-hmm. and cause lightning strikes and start more mm-hmm. fires, and on and on and on it went. It was a lot.
That's amazing. And it's amazing that you were able to persevere through that. And I'm so glad that you're on the other side of it. And I'm so glad that you're, you know, that you were able to write this brilliant book through it. But, you know, it, what I find so interesting is that you do spend quite a bit of time in the book. I mean, the book is laid out like a pretty standard Llewellyn style. I mean, you know, I don't even want to call it Llewellyn style, but like a pagan 101 style, you know, introductory book, in that when you introduce a concept, there certainly are like a lot of lists of correspondences and things to do and spells and stuff like that. But on those interstitial bits and on all of the descriptors and in the chapters where you're really like digging deep, you give us a profound insight to your perspective as a practicing Australian witch. What was so important? Because like you said in the beginning, you know, your first draft, your initial draft, your first stabs at the book were fire safety and focusing on fire as an element and research about, you know, the gods or crystals or plants or spells or whatever that you were including. Then you went back in and you included this brilliant look at, you know, Southern hemispheric, Australian-centric, Australian-focused witchcraft. What was so important about getting that message out?
The Southern hemispheric stuff is something that we don't see a lot of in our pagan books. So I'm going to show my age, but I grew up through and came into witchcraft during the late 90s and the early 2000s. And it was when we had that big boom of witch authors and witch books coming out of the US, especially with Llewellyn, especially. I was lucky enough to also be on the tail end of Capel Bam books. And I think Mara Starling talked about this a little bit in an interview with you not long ago. We had this very interesting kind of balance between these sort of very unique books from the UK talking about a very folksy type of European magic. And then we had the American neo-paganism as well. And for a long time, what we did was kind of in between there, between those two. And slowly the UK publishers have kind of gone by the wayside mostly. And now what people are consuming is mostly American. So I run a witchy study circle. And a lot of the people who come to us are younger people in their 20s, younger than me, people in their 20s, who have only, if they've read a book, and usually they haven't, usually they've just been on TikTok, which is fine. This is how people are coming to the craft now. But the books they're reading and consuming are American. And they don't even know that, say, the seasons or the Sabbats, rather, are reversed here. So, you know, around this time of year, we're coming up on the winter solstice here, but people will say, like, do we have a midsummer bonfire? Like, yeah, and things like that. So, yeah, and we see a lot of the Americanisms kind of sneaking in now. People say Mabon now, and they never used to.
What did they used to say?
Just autumn equinox.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, so I feel like that representation is really important. Some of the criticism I've had for the book was that it was confusing that there were Southern Hemisphere dates in there. and my reaction to that
oh,
was
oh, no, like, this isn't know, made specifically for me. Oh, darn.
Oh, you know, every book that I read as an Australian, mm-hmm. I have to translate out of American. So you can probably figure out, like, you can read the Northern Hemisphere date, which is I've put under the Southern Hemisphere date, and you can probably sort that out. I think you'll be okay.
Yeah, if an entire hemisphere full of people that are seeking this kind of knowledge and seeking this kind of information have had to spend the entirety of paganism just about, you know, doing calculations and having to look stuff up and seeing what the cognate is down there, we can do that for one book. Like, it's fair. Yep, it's fair.
I think so.
So I mean, I just want to dig into that concept a little bit further, because, you know, with the majority of pagan literature and pagan thought, kind of generally speaking, being decided by, you know, a pretty small group of mostly cisgender, heterosexual, white, American authors, thinkers, and publishers, really. I mean, we only have two major pagan publishers, and they're here in the US, and they publish mostly US-based authors, right? How does that affect your ability to relate to the broader pagan world, to the pagan community? I mean, do you feel like you're part of this worldwide community, being in Australia, or does it feel like, you know, a kid looking in the glass of the candy store and the rest of us are the pagan community and you're like, me too, out here?
It still does feel a lot like you guys are the cool kids over there.
You know, I'm not one of the cool kids, don't worry.
But we're like the dorky cousins. It does feel a little bit like that still. I think it's getting better slowly. Like we see authors like Laura O'Brien. Mara Starling's got a book coming out with Llewellyn now, which I'm really excited about.
I mean, started reading it and it's so good.
And signing her on, they've doubled their amount of Welsh authors overnight. So, you know, I think they're getting better, the Americans, in seeing that there are places outside of America and there are witches there, and the witchcraft there looks different. Mm-hmm. But I think the witchcraft that seekers are coming to is still very, very influenced by America, until they sort of look deeper and look at sort of local stuff.
Too. One of the things that I really appreciated when I read your book was that your introductions and your discussions of each chapter that's typically included in an introductory book, you know, a chapter on crystals, a chapter on deities associated with fire, a chapter on plants, et cetera, et cetera. You know, when you write an intro book, you sort of have to include a little bit of everything, right? But your introductions to those and discussions of them is so socially conscious. It's so socially aware. You are so pointed. You're gentle, but you're pointed in your guidance to the reader. You know, that cultural appropriation is a very real thing to be cognizant of when you are searching and dabbling your way through learning a new magical concept. You know, you take head on things like crystals and the mining industry, and you know, you talk about plants, don't eat all of them, please, you know, et cetera, et cetera. You know, you really kind of dig into this very conscious, very modern, very aware version of walking a witchy path. Was it just naturally the way that, I mean, you know, was that a conscious choice on your part, or was it just, this is the only way that I know how to write this book?
I've wanted to be an author since I was six. And I always actually wanted to write witchy books for a while too. And I decided once I signed for this book, I was going to write the book that I wish I had had in my hands as a beginner. Because when you're a beginner, especially when you're a beginner pre sort of the internet really taking off, you had to do a lot of unlearning along the way. So I guess I just sort of thought, what if we got it right the first time and we didn't have to go back and continually amend huge parts of our practice? I mean, obviously we change our practice all the time.
Sure.
That's human and normal, but what if we got things right the first time? You write about this in your book a little bit too, but this idea of what feels right really bugs me. Because, yes, do what feels right, absolutely, but there's a reason things feel right for you, and you need to be looking into why that is. And, no, there aren't witch police that are going to turn up at your doorstep and, hello, what are you doing? What do you reckon you're doing in there? You know, you can do what you like, but do it consciously and do it in an educated way. And, yeah, education was the thing here. Just when really disturbed my dog.
You actually woke mine up too.
I'm sorry.
No, it's great. She needs to quit taking a nap. So, you know, you are also a teacher. And it really comes through in your work, how gentle and educational you are, and how just incredibly well-versed in the topic you are. And I wonder, you know, kind of in this conversation about globalized paganism, the younger students that are coming to you now, are there, you know, what are the kinds of things that they are, one, maybe needing to unlearn, but on the other hand, is there anything that these newer witchy folks are inspiring you to do? Is there anything that they've inspired you to change or to grow into?
It was really interesting. So when I started this whole thing, it was when I turned 35. I think it was John Beckett wrote in his book, if you are over 35, you need to be taking on students. You should be mentoring people. Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly how I felt as well. Yeah.
Okay, so I am 35, like right now. Do I have to teach or can I wait a year?
You'll need to or ask 10. John Beckett.
Nobody needs to learn from me. I need to have a conversation with John. We need to amend that. I'm not an adult. Nobody should listen to me.
The first students that I had, because we had a little questionnaire that people filled in when they applied. So we run a free course, but we sort of pick and choose who gets to be a part of it. And the first people that applied, I had a question on there that said, what is your favorite witch book and why? Which, you know, I thought was pretty reasonable. And literally nobody had read any books. And I thought back to when, like, in the 2000s, in the aughts, when we used to be like, oh, look at him, he's read one book and suddenly he's like an expert. We don't even have that anymore. Mm-hmm. So people are learning from content online, which is fine, but it meant I had to go and learn this content, and I had to go and look at TikTok. I'm very old. And I didn't realize this until I got onto TikTok. Yeah, I'm very old. So I learned a lot about what this next generation of witchcraft looks like. And it's very different to mine. And that's okay. I think it would be really problematic if it looked the same. And this is a similar thing that we have in traditional Wiccan spaces. You know, if my Wicca looked the same, exactly the same as what people were doing in the 60s and 70s, there would be some serious questions asked, you know. So I've learned to be adaptive. Our first sessions often kind of devolve into these Q&A sessions where we end up debunking stuff we've heard on that people have heard online. But also people are sharing stuff as well. People seem to know a lot more about things like astrology than I did coming into this whole thing. And generally people seem to be, the younger generation seem to be better at things like not culturally appropriating and consent and things like that, which, as somebody who runs community events, often it's the older generations that require a little more gentle schooling on those things.
One of the things that is just making me smile ear to ear is hearing you talk about meeting your students where they are. You know, when a student comes to you or when a prospective student comes to you and says, you know, I haven't read anything, but these are the 10 YouTube channels that I watch. Here are the TikTok people that I read or, you know, listen to or watch, whatever. Yeah. You know, here are the people, here are the Twitter accounts that I follow. Here are the Instagram accounts that I follow. I mean, that's, and hearing that and taking that in and saying, okay, that is a valid way to have started learning. You do not need to have read a book to start learning. One, because so much of what we do is oral tradition anyways, and it's so right. Personal to people. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to be the first person to say, I I thought everybody needed to read, because when I started, that was the only way that I could learn anything. I mean, there were no podcasts. There were no podcast. There was no YouTube. There was no TikTok. There was no Twitter. There was no Facebook. There was no any of that. If you wanted to know something, you had to go to a bookstore and you got like 6 books to choose from and you read all of them. And you thought, well, because it's on the printed page, it is the absolute truth. And there, you know, someone, capital S, somewhere has vetted all this information, and it is the true, accurate gospel of witchcraft. And, you know, what you come to find out later on is so much of that isn't true. And the idea that you just said, where you're debunking things that you've seen online, books were no different. I mean, we act as though a book is some kind of sacred text, in the sense of that it is this infallible thing, that everything written inside of it is, you know, 100% factual all the time, forever and ever. And that's simply not true. I mean, we spent decades, you know, talking about all the way up to, I'm listening to old episodes of the show with my Patreon supporters and hearing myself talk about Scott Cunningham's Book of Shadows, where he once again talks about how very real the Burning Times myth was, where 9 million women were burned at the stake for practicing this unbroken line of witchcraft, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm like, we published that for decades and never thought to fact check it when the facts were available.
And not only did we publish it for decades, but it was accepted as gospel for decades. People older than me, so a lot of people who we would call elders were fed that as the truth and like the one and only truth. And for a long time, people thought they were reconstructing this ancient Celtic faith, you know.
And I appreciate that you are so open to say, okay, you know what? We're an oral tradition. This is how people learn. This is how people learn this spirituality. I mean, if you don't have someone that can sit there and take your hand and teach you, someone can record a TikTok and take you into their kitchen and show you how they prepare this. You know, someone can make a long form YouTube video and spend 10 minutes teaching you the basics of how they interact with fire, how they interact with storms, how they interact with water magic, et cetera, et cetera. That's no less valid a place to learn. You just need to it's much more obvious that you're just taking in this one person's perspective.
Absolutely. So in the real world, I'm a literacy specialist and a language acquisition expert. And I work with young people and young adults who have issues and disorders around that. The literacy rates in the Western world are staggeringly a lot worse than you would think. So we're at about 52% of people who are document illiterate. So that means that these are people who cannot get through an everyday thing like signing a rental agreement for a house or a mobile phone contract or something like that without needing some kind of assistance to properly understand it. In witchcraft and pagan spaces, dollars to donuts, I reckon that level would be higher, because this is something that attracts the marginalized a lot of the time, broadly speaking. So as authors, where does that leave us? I think we need to make this accessible as we can. And if that means, you know, people can learn from videos, then fine. It doesn't matter where you get the information. What matters is what you do with it. The magic's in the doing, right? The only thing that makes you a witch is doing witchcraft.
I couldn't agree more. But what I love is how you said, I'm going to go learn what you're learning. I need to go partake of that. And I think that that's something that other people at your level need to hear from a peer. You know, because I do it. We all do it. You know, it is this natural thing to buck against something new. My dog's just going to sit here and cough for a second. Okay. That's good. It's this natural thing that we have where, you know, anything, it's the appeal to novel. Well, it's almost like appeal to It's lack of appeal to novelty. It's the revulsion of novelty. But anything new is terrible because of, you know, it is not the way that we have always done things. So TikTok is bad because that's not how you should be learning. YouTube is bad because that's not how you should be learning. Podcasts are bad. Blogs are bad. Blah, 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 blah. And then those people, you know, the younger people who were blogging aged up and suddenly blogs gain legitimacy and yada, yada, yada. You know, as the TikTok creators go from being 15 to 22, 23 year olds and become 25 to 35 year olds, that is going to be a legitimate form of communication. And whatever the new thing is going to be the bad thing. You know, how dare you guys learn, you know, blah, 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 in that way. So talk to me a little bit about, do you feel like it is common? I mean, you know, do you see other creators? Do you see other teachers doing what you're doing and going and learning? And also, just to piggyback on that, what's the most surprisingly good thing that you've learned from going and meeting people where they are?
Probably, I think there are a lot of teachers meeting this kind of need. Like, I'm seeing older, and I'm using that word carefully, people now going onto TikTok and making videos and interacting with that younger audience and things like that. I think there seems to be a little bit less of the, oh, look at these TikTok kids, what are they bloody doing? There's a bit less of that now, I think. I only joined Twitter this year to have a little look at it. but I really like it because you can just be a dickhead. You just say a dickhead thing and just put it out to the universe. But like, that's another whole different community again, and there is different discourse happening on there. The best thing I've learned, I think, is that people have a sense of humor, which is really, really good. I think as witches, especially as we get into these spaces and start thinking of ourselves as leaders, which I still don't know how I feel about that word, but I think we are in a dangerous place where we can take ourselves a bit too seriously. Witchcraft is inherently silly, and you've got to be able to laugh at yourself. And that's one thing that I see a lot of, as well as there is some really good content on TikTok. There is some really kind of worrying content on TikTok, especially about Wicca. but there is some excellent content and some funny content and some very insightful, intelligent content too.
Sorry, my dog needed to join. This is Kika. She hasn't made a lot of social media appearances lately, but she needed to be a part of this. My baby.
I was going to say, she looks so much smaller in real life.
Yeah, y'all are, she doesn't do a lot of media appearances anymore. Aww. Eggsy has sort of taken that spot, but Kika's been with us a long time. She's our old girl. Well, she's not the oldest girl. We've got a cat who's older than her. So let's dive back into fire magic. So I have some listener questions, some people who are from Australia and some people who weren't. But I want to know, the first one that I have, here is from Donna, who asks, in general, what's it like to have and work with a fire season? We know there are plants and potentially other systems that get renewal after a fire, but it must be difficult to honor that when potentially facing personal destruction, person, loved ones, home, community, landscape, etc. And I know you actually pretty much directly address it, and we sort of talked about it previously, but talk to me a little bit more directly, like, you know, do you magically work with a fire season? Is that something that you all incorporate in your practices?
I mean, I'm not going to speak on behalf of all pagans ever. I think that's really not clever.
I mostly meant you and your circle. Sorry, I should have clarified. You and the people that you work with.
Yeah. It kind of comes back to the wheel of the year here. So the summertime, which for us is in December, is our dead season. So it gets so hot here in most of Australia. Most of the grass dies. A lot of things catch fire. We have droughts. We have dust. Sometimes our roads melt, which is a good time. So our midsummer is not this European idea of, you know, cherry wine and dappled sunshine and all of those things. Sometimes it can be on cooler days, I guess. But if you're working with the land around you, you're looking at a land that becomes quite barren and renews again once the rain starts again. Here where I live, we'll often have 3 or 4 months with no rain at all. And so sometimes workings in my community will be towards trying to get a drought to break or to make sure so the harvest festivals have a whole new meaning, the three harvest festivals, because your garden has come back to life and you can grow stuff again a lot of the time in a lot of places. So in terms of compared to like American and European paganism, it is very different, and that's probably how we work with it the most. I know there are a lot of workings.
Yeah, piggybacking off of that, another Australian listener actually wrote in and said, you know, most of Australia doesn't have four seasons. So how do you deal not just with the seasons being flipped, but how do you work with the seasons that you have? Which I mean, you know, I'm from Texas originally, and one of the things that I that sort of blew my mind when I moved where I live now here in Chicago is that we have four seasons, like four actual distinct seasons. And I wasn't used to that. In Texas, I was used to, you know, it did get so hot sometimes that our road melted, and you would regularly have newscasters go out and literally prove they could fry an egg on top of certain things.
Every year.
I don't know why. I'm like, we know it's hot. We know it's terrible. Yeah. It's bad. It's when it hasn't rained here in a year. Yes, it's bad. We know. But how do you work with the seasons that you have? I think that's really valuable information. It's something that you talk about in the book. You know, you all obviously still have solstices and equinoxes. You have the same calendar the rest of us do, but you all have this wet and you have dry. And that's what you work with. That's sort of, you know, Texas is a little bit like that. So, you know, how do you work with that? And how do you coach your trainees to work with that?
I mean, Australia is roughly the same size as the United States. So it's really big. It has lots of microclimates. So it's different here to even what it is maybe 20 minutes up the road. It's a bit drier. Where I live, so I'm in Victoria, which is like the bottom right-hand corner of Australia. So we are lucky enough to have the four seasons. The leaves have all fallen off the oak tree in my backyard. It's raining. It's winter at the moment. Further up north, it's a little bit different and you have those two seasons. The workings certainly work around them. In Queensland, which is one of the northern states, they don't have a lot of trees that drop their leaves in the autumn. So they don't even... a few of my friends up there talk about not noticing that it's going to be the autumn equinox anytime soon because they're not watching the trees. So you often don't get those indicators from the land that you would get elsewhere. So, yeah, I guess it's just a matter of it comes back to, yes, it's fine to learn things from American books and from online and whatever, but you need to be working with the land that's around you and maybe you don't need to have an autumn equinox ritual at all if that's not something that you feel you need to celebrate. We're not locked into this, you know?
Yeah, I think that one of the things that the community, it's sort of like the Wicca washing of the community is that this, you know, everything has to have the eight Sabbats, right? You know, everyone has to have these or some version of those. And it just, you know, those seasonal changes, they aren't experienced by everybody. And it can leave a lot of people feeling left out or unsure of how to cope. I mean, again, I very much relate to what you're saying, especially of those people that are like, yeah, the leaves didn't really fall here, or they don't fall until very, very late or something like that. Or this year they didn't even fall. You know, I've had those years. I've been there, I've done that. And it's just bizarre to be somewhere that, and, you know, and be reading books and like, oh, well, at this time the leaves are changing or it's getting cooler. And I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about. It is 98 degrees here and like 94% humidity. And it is not this cool, calm, sweet little autumnal equinox that you guys are having up there. So, you know, I'm so glad that your version of the craft is just saying, okay, well, what is the land? Ignore the book. What is the land around you doing? And connect to the land around you.
One of my favorite stories comes from Perth, which is over the other side of Australia, Western Australia. It's quite hot over there. When witchcraft was first taking off in the 1970s, there's this story of this coven so the first books that sort of made their way over here were What Witches Do and things like that, the Pharaohs. And there's a story of them standing in a park in the middle of summer, must have been 98 degrees or more, trying to do this midwinter ritual. And the story goes that the high priestess just put the book down and said, fuck this. What are we doing? And I love that. That was very Australian. But we've got to adapt, right? Outside of a specific tradition, there are no rules. Do what feels right, but be educated and know about that and know what you're working with.
So speaking of do what feels right, but be educated and know what you're working with, another one of the listeners wanted to know, because, you know, a lot of pagan discourse, one, is very North American centric. And so when conversations of cultural appropriation or, you know, that kind of topic come up, it's very focused on, you know, we'll just use a very easy example, like white sage being appropriated from Native American indigenous, culture. In Australia, obviously, you do not have Native American indigenous culture, but you do have Aboriginal culture, and you do have your own pretty dire, pretty bloody history of settling and colonizing and having to live in a world where, you know, where you all are and the land you walk on belong to someone else, et cetera, et cetera. How are those kinds of conversations dealt with in your community?
For a long time, they weren't. I think it's probably similar to what happened elsewhere in the world. We are getting better. There's a lot of work to be done, especially in pagan spaces where it is overwhelmingly, it's a white space. It's something that's becoming more diverse, but, you know, typically we got a lot of white people here. We live on stolen land here, and not only do we live on stolen land, but we live on one of the largest countries and one of the only countries left that has no treaty with its indigenous people. So you need to go very carefully and very respectfully and as educated as you can be, and you educate yourself. There are places that are sacred here that I wouldn't go and practice pagan ritual. There are things you can do like acknowledgements of country and things like that before rituals, and that's becoming more of the norm. Just like you would have maybe 5 years ago, everyone was putting a consent culture policy in place for their public rituals. Now we also have like things like acknowledgements of country and statements of solidarity or how we're working with the land. We're talking about the names of the indigenous countries that we're actually working on for the first time and actually speaking those names and using those names in language, which I think is really good. But yeah, there's a lot more work to be done. I still occasionally see it's not as bad as it used to be, but you do see a little bit of a cultural appropriation type stuff. And I guess, like you said, you need to go gently, but you need to be firm and sort of educate and point people in the right direction of, you know, if you want to learn like the native name of something in this land, this is the place you go. And you do it in a way that you are giving back more than you're taking away, always, when you're working with First Nations people.
What does that look like for you from an educator standpoint to give back more than you're taking?
So I'll use the example of Mount Franklin. So the Mount Franklin Pagan Gathering is, I think it's either the longest running or one of the longest running in the world. And that happens nearby. It's in a volcano crater that you can actually drive into. And it's the 40th year this year that we're going to do our Beltane at Mount Franklin. And this is also a sacred site to the Dja-Dja-Wurrung people of the area. And it was a place of initiation and renewal for a really long time. So in recent years, we've done things like got traditional owners to come out and talk to us before we start our ceremony. We've had things like welcome to countries conducted before we have people in. We have some very clear policies in place about what can and can't be done to the land. And when we leave...
I'm so sorry to interrupt, but what is a welcome to country?
So a welcome to country is conducted by Indigenous people who are of that country, welcoming people to come and either like to do their thing on that country.
Gotcha. And do they get any kind of benefit from this? Is there like a financial benefit?
There is a financial benefit. So they are
paid. Oh, good. Okay.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah. Of course. Yes. So yeah, there's a welcome to country, which can only be done by an Indigenous person, and an acknowledgement of country is becoming the norm here for anyone working on Indigenous land. Yeah. So
that's amazing.
Yeah. It's something I'm going to ask you to do before your show, actually, if that's okay with me.
Of course.
I'm coming to you from Dja-Dja-Wurrung country. So
of course. Yeah.
But yes, and also over the weekend for our festival, we don't have any amplified music. We don't have things like generators on site if we can help it. And we always leave the mountain looking better than it did. We're working with local groups to keep the place nice, to get some bins installed because there's no rubbish bins there, and campers, hopefully non-pagan campers, just leave their crap everywhere, you know, so just things like that.
That's amazing. Sorry. My dog again.
That's all right. Ooh. I thought mine would be barking, actually. We've got kangaroos that come and eat the vegetables.
Sorry,
the
you have kangaroos?
Yeah, they're as tall as me, so they can just hop the fence and does they eat our veggies.
Does anybody have a pet kangaroo?
No. No.
Why not? They look like they'd be really fun pets.
They're as big as you.
I know.
And
I want to
hug these claws
one.
Like
I
these.
No, I want to hug
where
one.
Where they can disembowel you like this.
I know. Oh, I mean, you could only hug it once, but it'd be fun.
We have koalas here too, a couple, not many.
You know, they have too many STIs for me. Thanks. All that koala chlamydia.
In the middle of the night, they go, it's terrifying. It's horrible. Do not put that in your podcast. Do not put that in your podcast.
7,000% going in podcast. 7,000%. Just, in fact, it's going in the plug for the podcast. Listen to Josephine Winter. Give her koala sex impression. Come for the fire magic, stay for the koala sex.
I am a serious priestess.
Is there anything that surprised you that you didn't know? Is there anything that sort of shook your own understanding of working with fire while you were while you were researching the book, writing the book, you know, I've found that sort of the process of researching and writing sort of makes you question the way that you thought about something before, and to make sure you really think, you know, but I've always said it this way, but before I put it down on paper, I might really want to like sit and think, like, have I thought about this in a while?
Probably a lot to do with the research and mythologies. I haven't really thought about like archetypes and things like that since I was at uni. But just the way that so many different cultures approach fire and fire deities in sort of a set few different ways. And these are all completely different cultures with different stories. I'm not saying that they're the same, but the way that, you know, most cultures will have a fire deity that is destructive. Most cultures will also have a fire deity that is around the hearth and cooking and hearth and home and things like that. And also just about the feeling of magic, which is something I don't think is talked about enough in the books. And it's something I'm trying to sort of nut out for my second book at the moment. The idea of a fire, if you think of a fire lit in the darkness, it creates this circle around it. And for thousands of years, that has meant safety and home and all of that. And I don't know if you read Terry Pratchett, but thousands of years of belief in that, that's got to amount to something, you know? And yeah, okay, witchcraft is not old. It's certainly not as old as people like to think it is. But the idea of something like standing and staring up at the moon and feeling special, that is something very, very ancient and something special. Yeah.
I love that. I'm sitting here nodding along because I think if you shoved Hayao Miyazaki, Terry Pratchett, and Neil Gaiman together, like that's probably like my spiritual worldview somewhere in that little milieu of people and ideology.
We have a lot to discuss.
Well, it's convenient that we're talking then. Are you a Miyazaki fan? Are you Studio Ghibli?
I am.
What's your favorite? Or what's your, I mean, it's hard to ask, but like, what's your go-to? Like it's been a day, it's been a time, you need some comfort. What's your comfort Miyazaki?
Probably Princess Mononoke.
Really? That's your comfort go-to?
Yeah, I'm
really
up.
Like that's more along the line. Like that's Miyazaki's, that's somewhere up there with like his version of the Avengers, like that's his big action epic, you know?
Yeah
that and, well, I mean, obviously
Totoro. I like Totoro as well. Yeah.
I always go for Porco Rosso.
Yes.
People forget about that one, and I don't know why. It's beautiful and it's a little bit more adult, which I love. But it's, oh my god, they a couple of years ago they did they had the movies playing in theaters again, you know, for, you know, every couple months you could go see another one.
Nice.
And I got to see Porco Rosso on the screen, the big screen, and it's, those backgrounds are just the way that movie's meant to be seen. It's gorgeous. Gorgeous film.
It's beautiful. It's like watching a painting. It's just
I just want to dive into his worlds. They're amazing. Well, Josephine Winter, I'm so glad that I got to dive in. Speaking of diving into, I'm so glad I got to dive into this book with you, this fire magic book. Thank you so much for being here, for talking with me today, for talking to me about fire magic. It's one of my favorite topics. I am always the one to light the fire. I'm always the one to tend the fire. You know, let me light the things, let me stamp the things out. You know, but what I appreciate the most about your book is that it's not just an introductory book. You know, if somebody just flips the book open, you know, so many of these books are just sort of like yet another rearrangement of correspondences. And I get how this book could easily have been that, where somebody could grab it and just be like, okay, well, I'm interested in fire magic. Flip, go into the crystal section and I'm going crystal shopping. But even if they do that here, they're still going to get something valuable, interesting, novel, and a completely different perspective than we're used to seeing. And I think it will force people to sort of stop and get say, you know what, I think I'm going to go back to the beginning and read this like a book is supposed to be read start to finish. So thank you so much for writing it. And thank you for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great.
Of course. If people want to get to know a little bit more about you, where can they find you online?
So I'm just Winter's Tidings on most socials. I am not on TikTok.
We're going to get you on there. We're going to, you must come join us on the Witch Talk. I promise it's not as scary as.
Maybe.
I if Corey Hutchison can get on TikTok, you might.
Corey Hutchison's on TikTok?
Yes. Corey Hutchison is on TikTok, madam, and his stuff is great. It's great.
It's great.
That man gives me such imposter syndrome. I hate him to death. Ugh, but I love him.
Yeah.
Ugh. Well, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great.
Well, rioters, that is going to do it here for us today. Thank you so much to Josephine Winter. Her book, Fire Magic, is out now from Llewellyn Books, wherever books are sold. Please go get it. It is very, very, very good. Links to find more of Josephine are on the website at incitingariot.com. If you like this show, you like what you hear, and you want to support it, there are a number of ways that you can do that. Some free ways would be liking and sharing the show on social media. Say that three times fast. You can also rate the show 5 stars on Apple Podcast and leave a review. I don't know why I'm tripping over my words. I actually just finished recording the audiobook for The Dabbler's Guide to Witchcraft. And let me tell you, I stumble over my words a whole lot more than I think I do or thought I did or whatever. So there's an editor somewhere right now getting certainly earning their paycheck with trying to edit my silly voice. So anyways, other than liking and sharing the show on social media, if you would like to keep the show free and producing on a regular basis, please consider chipping in whatever you can. You can do that by buying me a coffee, which is a one-time monetary donation in an amount of your choosing. Or if you would like to get a little bit more for your donation and you want to do it on a little bit more of a regular basis, you can join my Patreon. Patrons receive additional audio and video content. In the context of this particular episode, they got about 20 extra minutes of content. So they got to hear Josephine and I chat about all sorts of stuff, as well as archived episodes, a private Discord server, and monthly chats with special guests. And I can tell you that patrons are going to receive quite a lot of Dabbler's Guide goodies coming up in the weeks and months to come. I think there's going to be custom tarot cards. I think there's going to be audiobook previews, a blooper reel from the audiobook. I requested a blooper reel, and they said yes because I'm a masochist. So lots of other fun, early fun things for patrons. And you can do that at patreon.com/incitingprojects. You can do that for as little as $1 a month or whatever you can. Once again, I'm just going to keep plugging the dang book. I'm sorry if you're tired of hearing about it. It's my baby. So if you'd like to pre-order The Dabbler's Guide to Witchcraft, which is my book coming out this September 28th from Simon & Schuster, you can do that at bit.ly/dabblersguide. Email me about this show at firelight, firelyte, at incitingariot.com. I am also at incitingariot on most forms of social media, but I'm going to leave you. I'm this is done. This episode's done. But as always, I will leave you with love and light, firelight.